Section 1. Introduction. In today's wired age, it is common knowledge that setting up one's own website is not a particularly difficult endeavor. Indeed, anyone who has run a broad-based search through one of the major search engines has likely come across myriad homemade pages created by individuals reflecting their personal interests or some life ambition. To set up a website, one really only needs an internet-connected computer, a web browser equipped with a basic text editing application, and an internet service provider, also known as an ISP, that offers web hosting for its users. Such users are unlikely to seek legal advice, and the range of legal issues that arise in relation to such sites tend to be limited to copyright and trademark violations by the site creators. E-commerce, however, presents a wholly different challenge for the site creator and the legal practitioner. The sophisticated nature of the technology required, the number of players involved in setting up a site and facilitating transactions, the privacy concerns of consumers who may be giving the site information about themselves, and a host of other realities of online business make effective legal representation critical in this area. In addition, e-commerce setup often requires great speed due to the nature of the industry, therefore adding an additional layer of complexity that calls for even more vigilance and preparedness on the part of the legal practitioners in structuring transactions and in advising clients. This section of the course will examine some general steps that most U.S. e-businesses will follow in establishing an e-commerce site and explore the necessity or possibility of legal representation at different critical junctures of the setup process.
Section 2. Registering a domain name. In setting up a website, the first step usually undertaken is registering a domain name. A domain name is the unique address that guides a user's browser to the computer on which the website resides. It usually consists of two elements, the top-level domain, also known as TLD, and the second-level domain, also known as SLD, which some simply refer to as the domain name. The most recognizable example of a TLD is the familiar .com found at the end of many web addresses. In addition, there is another set of TLDs reserved for specific countries. These are known as the country code TLDs, or CC TLDs, and include domains such as .jp for Japan, .fr for France, and the much ballyhooed .tv for Tuvalu. The administration of these sites was given over to authorities in each nation, some of whom have restricted registration to residents of that nation, while others, most notably Tuvalu, have opened registration to anyone willing to pay the price. Finally, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, also known as ICANN, recently selected 7 new generic TLDs from proposals submitted by private applicants, including a new .biz TLD for businesses, and .pro TLD for lawyers, physicians, and accountants. Registration in the new gTLDs is not expected to begin before the fall of 2001. Part A, choosing a top-level domain. Choosing a TLD, then, is the first step in registering a domain name. There are many registry services for the 3 unrestricted gTLDs with a variety of prices and service options available. One must closely review the terms of the registrar's service agreement policy. The domain holder's rights in a gTLD domain name are very tenuous. Most registrars reserve the right to revoke a domain registration at their own discretion. Courts have only just begun to explore the boundaries of domain names and property rights. In one of the few cases addressing domain names as property, a state court in Virginia ruled that a domain name is a form of intangible intellectual property subject to post-judgment creditor remedies. The case was later reversed when the Virginia Supreme Court ruled that the domain names at issue could not be garnished, but that court left open the question of whether the domain names themselves could be considered property. But a subsequent federal court decision cast some doubt on this conclusion before ultimately disposing of the case without definitively answering the question. In addition, all of the current open GTLDs, .com, .org, and .net must abide by a standard uniform domain name dispute resolution procedure under which the domain holder is subject to a mandatory resolution procedure if any trademark owner complains about the domain name. For more details about the UDRP, see the course section on disputes. In the end, most commercial concerns usually register the same name in all three GTLDs just to avoid confusing customers.
Part B, choosing a second-level domain. The next step is to choose a second-level domain, also known as an SLD or 2LD, something particularly important for those involved in e-commerce as they think about branding and trademarks. This choice is best made with the advice of trademark counsel. As most common words and short phrases have already been registered as second-level domains in the unrestricted GTLDs, a business may have to look to an unrestricted CCTLD or one of the new TLDs to register a manageable and easily remembered name. To find out if a name is available in the GTLDs, an e-business should use the verifying global registry service Whois Search. Each CCLD has its own Whois database, but many are searchable from All Whois and You Whois. One is safest when registering one's own trademark or trade name. If it already has been registered by another party, consult the UDRP or local law for possible grounds to force a transfer of the domain to you. If the other party has superior rights, or if you have not yet established any legal right in the name you wish to use, an important first step in registering a second-level domain is a trademark search. Due to the focus on trademarks of the ICANN UDRP, under which a domain name registrant may be forced to give up a domain name to its trademark holder, it is crucial to make sure the domain name being registered is not a registered trademark belonging to someone else. This can be accomplished by running a trademark search. Please see the website for more information.
Part C, choosing a registrar. Virtually all domain registrars have a very simple search process to see whether a name is available, and many also have tools to help users find available domain names containing similar words if the original choice is unavailable. After finding an available domain name, top and second level, most registrars give registrants a choice of options in terms of pricing and duration. Registrars may only grant domain names for fixed periods of time, with an option to renew when the period lapses. And most registrars give options for different registration durations. Choosing a longer registration period has the advantage of locking the registrant into a registration at a price that will not rise, and some registrars offer discounts for longer duration registrations. Different registrars also may offer differing packages of services for additional fees. Network Solutions, for instance, offers hosting services for registrants. Some registrars do not offer hosting, instead requiring the registrant to provide them with domain name server, also known as DNS information before they will register the name. The easiest road for those not quite ready to set up their websites is to choose a registrar that offers free parking, which basically means that the registrar registers the name without requiring DNS information and quote-unquote parks the name on its server until the registrar is ready to use the name. While many registrants simply choose the first registrar they come to, the above options considered in light of the user's needs will aid in choosing the best registrar. An equally important consideration that is often overlooked, however, is the terms of service, also known as TOS agreement, or the registration contract. Unfortunately, the registrars are often the guilty party in this oversight, as terms of service agreements require the registrant to follow an often subtle link. Most registrars do not even require the Terms of Service Agreement page to be accessed before processing an order. in addition to general contractual language concerning payment of fees and what constitutes breach, there are several other components common in GTLD registration terms of service agreements detailed on the course website.
Section 3, Hosting. After registering a domain name, most businesses will need to arrange for hosting services. As hosting is a relatively new industry, the actual services offered in a web hosting agreement vary from provider to provider, making it difficult to generalize what exactly comprises hosting. In general, a host basically stores web pages for a client and operates a giant switchboard of sorts that connects web users' computers with requested pages from the hosted company. Hosts generally facilitate such storage and connections by operating hosting centers, large warehouse spaces that contain the computers on which clients' web pages are stored, and connect them to the internet via high-bandwidth fiber optic lines. Part A, Advantages of Utilizing a Host. While some companies may have the hardware, office space, and personnel resources to create their own servers and host their own sites, utilizing a host in its hosting center provides some distinct advantages over managing one's own server. For one thing, outsourcing such services can save considerable money. Hosting often runs about one quarter of the cost of running one's own site in terms of the aforementioned resources. Utilizing a host may also decrease the chances of problems due to security breaches, power outages, and the like if one selects a hosting center with round-the-clock security, backup power generators, climate-controlled storage space, and buildings created to withstand natural disasters. A final advantage of utilizing a host is speed. The proximity of the server to the user is a major factor in transaction speed, although other factors affecting speed, such as bandwidth speed, server speed, and number of hops may lead to situations where the closest server is not necessarily the fastest. Hosting centers may also give servers direct, high capacity, and high speed access to the internet backbone, therefore obviating the need to rewire one's physical place of business for the necessary level of connectivity. Employing a host gives users the advantage of faster connectivity to users and consumers who are located far from the headquarters of the company. Using a host also allows a business to set up a number of alternative servers in various locales in order to bring greater speeds to a greater number of people. Part B, Legal Issues and Hosting Agreements. While registering a domain name can and is often done without legal representation, the many legal issues arising in the context of a hosting agreement make the services of a transactional lawyer a necessity. This is especially important considering the somewhat vague definition of what is included in hosting, as the practitioner must make certain that all of the e-commerce client's needs are met when drafting a hosting agreement or making changes to boilerplate hosting agreements. There are several major areas that require special attention to detail when structuring deals, including equipment, maintenance, service stoppages, security, and allocation of risk. Please see the course website for a checklist of issues to address in hosting agreements.
Section 4, ISP Liability. A major issue in the internet context is determining who can be held responsible for wrongful acts on the part of internet users. Should only the user who actually commits the act be held liable, or should the internet service provider or website operator be held liable for the wrongful acts of its users? These questions take on particular significance for an e-business when considering different options for a website. Offering consumers the ability to post reviews of products or participate in chat room or bulletin board discussions raises issues in this area. When looking at hosting relationships as well, there is a question whether hosts can be held liable for wrongful acts of the parties that host. Courts have taken different approaches to address these issues, relying on common law principles, case law precedents, and statutory provisions. The first major case to arise in the realm of ISP liability was Covey v. CompuServe. Cubby involved a situation where allegedly defamatory statements regarding the plaintiffs were published on a CompuServe bulletin board, resulting in suit against both the content developer and service provider, CompuServe. In granting summary judgment for CompuServe, the district court emphasized the fact that CompuServe had no editorial control over or even knowledge of the contents of the statements published, and therefore acted as a mere distributor of the materials available on its message boards and other online fora. The court relied on general principles emanating from the First Amendment, as interpreted in analogous cases dealing with traditional media, to rule that a distributor cannot be held liable for distributed publications containing defamatory statements if it neither knows nor has reason to know of the allegedly defamatory statements. The rule established in Cubby thus provided an incentive for ISPs to remain ignorant of the actual contents of the publications on its network in order to be considered a distributor immune from liability. The next major development in the realm of ISP liability came in the case of Stratton Oakmont Incorporated v. Prodigy Services Company. In that case, the court held that the Internet service provider Prodigy could be held liable for libelous statements posted on a bulletin board it operated by anonymous users, even though it was not aware of the statements. Key to the court's analysis was that the ISP in this case was more akin to a publisher than a distributor, and was therefore not entitled to special protection under the defamation law. The court further reasoned that because the ISP made representations to the public concerning its regulation and screening of content on its bulletin boards, it was exposed to greater liability than an ISP not making such representations. In the court's opinion, the fact that Prodigy screened only for indecent and obscene content and not defamation was of no consequence. While this case could be reconciled with Cubby, and indeed the court relied on Cubby to reach its outcome, due to the fact that the ISP here attempted to exercise editorial control, the reasoning led to the seemingly perverse result that service providers who actually made an effort to police their sites would be judged more harshly than those who chose to remain totally ignorant.
Part A, the Communications Decency Act. Congress attempted to address the issue raised in the Stratton Oakmont case through the Communications Decency Act, CDA, of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Although the main thrust of the CDA, which attempted to regulate obscene and violent content on the Internet, was eventually struck down as violative of the First Amendment, a safe harbor provision dealing with ISP liability was left intact. That provision, 47 United States Code, Section 230, Subsection C, was drafted to explicitly overrule decisions such as Stratton Oakmont by not subjecting those ISPs that made an effort to screen content to stricter liability than those who made no effort at all. The provision, which is also known as the Good Samaritan defense, states, quote, "No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider," end quote. The subsection goes on to preclude civil liability for ISPs attempting to regulate or block access to offensive content. These surviving provisions of the CDA played a prominent role in the case of Zarin versus AOL. In that case, a user pretending to be Mr. Zarin posted comments on an AOL message board, offering t-shirts with offensive and tasteless slogans regarding the Oklahoma City bombing, which had occurred just days earlier. The posting, which included Zarin's phone number, resulted in a large volume of angry phone calls, including death threats. While AOL personnel removed this original posting when Zarin notified them, they refused to publish a retraction, and subsequent postings offering merchandise with even more offensive slogans soon followed. The problem was exacerbated when an Oklahoma City radio station broadcast Zarin's phone number and encouraged listeners to call him and let him know what they thought about his offer. Zarin's suit against AOL claimed that the ISP had failed in its duty to remove the defamatory posting promptly, to notify its subscribers of the message's false nature, and to effectively screen future defamatory material. AOL relied on 47 U.S.C. Section 230 as an affirmative defense, and the trial court granted its motion to dismiss. In upholding the district court's ruling, the Fourth Circuit explored Congress's intent in passing this section of the CDA. Quote, "The purpose of this statutory immunity is not difficult to discern. Congress recognized the threat that tort-based lawsuits pose to freedom of speech in the new and burgeoning Internet medium. Faced with potential liability for each message republished by their services, interactive computer service providers might choose to severely restrict the number and type of messages posted. Congress considered the weight of the speech interest implicated and chose to immunize service providers to avoid any such restrictive effect." End of quote. The court went on to suggest that Section 230 of the CDA was drafted to respond to and overrule Stratton and Oakmont, seeking to remove the disincentive to self-regulation that resulted from that line of reasoning. Along these lines, the court also rejected Zirin's claim that the rules applying to a distributor, as opposed to a publisher, should apply to AOL in this case, arguing that such a conception would defeat the purpose of the statute. Although the Zirin court thus recognized the broad sweep of ISP immunity under the CDA, it did stress that the act allows an injured party to seek redress from the individual responsible for the injury. Zirin, however, was unable to identify the defamatory poster, and therefore was left without an easy remedy.
Part B, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, 1998. Congress again addressed the issue of ISP liability through legislation in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, also known as DMCA, of 1998, which revised portions of the existing federal copyright law and added new provisions. Title II, Section 202 of the DMCA, which was incorporated into the Copyright Code as 17 U.S.C. Section 512, addresses limitations on liability relating to copyrighted material online. Specifically, the provision grants an ISP immunity for possible copyright violations as a result of transitory digital network communications, system caching, storage of copyrighted materials by users in ISP storage space, and directing users to particular locations through links, directories, or other tools. While the first two of these provisions attempt to address copyright issues that arise specifically due to technological processes, such as passively forwarding network traffic on the way to its ultimate destination, the second two broadly touch on more traditional issues of contributory or vicarious liability for copyright infringement that have closer analogs in the non-digital world. The immunities granted in these DMCA provisions are subject to numerous conditions that make the law somewhat convoluted. The most basic and important of these conditions are that the ISP have no knowledge of the infringing conduct of its users or infringing nature of its own links, and that once an infringement is discovered, it takes steps to expeditiously remove infringing material and suspend service to the infringing party. In this way, the DMCA offers a safe harbor to ISPs by withholding liability for infringement from ISPs that have no knowledge of an infringement. When infringement is discovered, the ISP can remain within the safe harbor and escape liability by promptly following the specified procedures for removal and termination once it is notified of the infringement. While this safe harbor combines with the protections of the CDA to give a broad immunity to ISPs, the DMCA provision may have the ancillary effect of impinging upon free speech by encouraging more stringent actions to be taken by ISPs against alleged infringers in an effort to remain within the safe harbor.
Part C, ISP liability and the e-business. What does all of this mean for the e-business? First of all, an e-business that does not have its own fully self-sufficient infrastructure needs an ISP of some sort, and these case law precedents and statutory provisions will clearly affect e-business ISP relations. Even in the case of the most self-sufficient e-business, there's usually an upstream service provider. Furthermore, to the extent that an e-business takes on attributes of an ISP, these precedents and provisions may apply directly to the e-business as a service provider. For most e-businesses, the host will be the ISP, and issues of ISP liability that arise may be incorporated into a hosting agreement. The default rule set forth by the CBA in the cases interpreting it in regards to defamatory or obscene content will immunize the host from liability for an e-business's wrongdoing in publishing such content. While a specific hosting agreement certainly may be drafted to reallocate the liability in these cases, there is little incentive for the host to do so, and the e-business itself is clearly in the best position to regulate its content. These considerations make it likely that the default rule will be followed. The DMCA safe harbor provision presents an opportunity for a practitioner to draft specific contractual clauses for a hosting arrangement to address the execution of the statutory processes. Because the DMCA safe harbor may give ISPs an incentive to overreact in shutting down sites that are allegedly infringing, an e-business may wish to modify a hosting agreement to allow recovery for damages due to improper termination of service. An e-business may also wish to draft contractual language concerning the processes by which a host ISP may shut down service. For instance, an agreement could require notice of pending termination to be given to the e-business and provide for a specific period of time security allegedly infringing conduct prior to termination or suspension of service. Such contractual provisions regarding recovery for improper termination or the process of termination can be a powerful tool to blunt the blow upon content providers and other internet users by the DMCA and its encouragement of vigilance on the part of ISPs. It should be noted, however, that contractual provisions that work within the contours of the DMCA and attempt to reach agreement on the ambiguous interpretive junctions of specific provisions will be more likely to withstand challenge, as the federal statute may be found to preempt any explicitly contrary contractual language in court proceedings. The other main situation in which an e-business may be affected by issues of ISP liability is that in which the e-business itself takes on the attributes of an ISP, opening itself up to potential liability for the acts of its users. This process of an e-business taking on the characteristics of an ISP is common for those websites that offer users more interactive services. An e-business may find it advantageous to give its customers fora, such as chat rooms, to discuss products and other topics related to the e-business. Or an e-business may wish to allow its consumers to post product reviews that potential buyers can then access. These chat rooms or review areas may be used in a manner that injures third parties, ranging from the posting of defamatory content to copyright infringement, either direct posting of copyrighted material or contributory infringement by posting sites where copyrighted material can be illegally obtained. Assessing whether an e-business can be held liable for such acts of its users depends on the construction of the statutes at issue. For more information on how the CDA and DMCA apply to these instances with e-businesses, please see the course website.
Section 5, Website Development. Part A, In-house Development versus Outsourcing. Like hosting, web design and programming is something that can be developed by in-house personnel or can be outsourced. While most businesses take advantage of the benefits of outsourcing, the hosting of servers, web design, and to a lesser extent, programming are often kept in-house for several reasons, such as control and the ability to make quick changes. However, it is not always feasible for every business to keep a fully equipped in-house design and programming team. Some small businesses may not have the budget or the pressing business need to develop their own programmers. Large businesses may choose to outsource certain aspects of the design and programming services, such as graphic design, editing, and back-end software development. Many of these oft-outsourced services have to do with design and programming aspects that are not site-specific. One reason for this is the idea that an outside party may not fully understand the vision and purpose of the e-business, so should work only on the more generic aspects of design and programming. In other cases, it may not be cost-effective to develop one's own designers and programmers for things that are not site-specific. The more mechanical an aspect of website functioning, the more likely it is to be outsourced. Thus, much programming outsourcing is geared towards back-end functionality and internal aspects that keep the website running smoothly behind the scenes. Part B, website development and infringing conduct or content. As with hosting, when programming and design services are outsourced, the e-business and its attorney must undertake an analysis regarding allocation of risk and responsibility through the services contract. Two main areas in which there can be problems are liability for copyright or trademark infringement and service disruptions or other problems due to malfunctioning programming. In terms of copyright, an e-business should communicate to a hired designer that all graphics, photographs, and text used on the website must be original or in the public domain. As most of the photographs and graphics currently used on websites and in print media are copyrighted, the e-business attorney must diligently attempt to determine whether non-original graphics and photos used by an outside designer are truly in the public domain. The attorney should also be aware of the fair use doctrine, as it may be useful in excerpting portions of text. A favorable review of the business's website or products, for instance, or other copyrighted media. Although it should be noted that use of copyrighted materials for commercial purposes enjoys less latitude for fair use analysis than non-commercial use. While these copyright concerns apply equally to businesses that design their own websites, it is important to note that contracting the work out will not save the website publisher itself from escaping liability for any infringement, due to the basic tort concept of vicarious liability. One possible way around this is to create a contract that specifically puts the burden of non-infringement on the contracted designer and holds it liable for any infringement. This does not absolve the publisher from copyright infringement, however, and a business may be limited to seeking post-judgment contribution from the designer, or may be left to satisfy a judgment if the designer is insolvent or otherwise judgment-proof. While such contractual language is still better than nothing, perhaps the best technique to employ is to carefully check a contracted designer's work or avoid using non-original content at all.
Part C, program malfunctions. Programming malfunctions and other associated problems can also be handled through contracts between the e-business and its hired programmers. To the extent that any such problems adversely affect customers, as in overcharges on credit cards, failure to register sales and ship products, etc., there are similarities to the copyright context regarding satisfaction of a wronged third party. This is a particularly grave concern when problems with programs lead to security breaches, which may result in anything from a hacker putting offensive material on a business's website to release of personal information and credit cards. Once again, when drafting a contract between an e-business and outside programmers, an attorney should be aware of possible problems that may result from faulty or otherwise malfunctioning programs. Contracts should address unforeseeable problems and necessary modifications to remedy them, as well as remedies for substandard or negligent programming. When hiring outside programmers, e-businesses should inquire into past problems the programmer's work may have developed, and their general service records and customer satisfaction, in order to make an informed judgment about the likelihood of problems and adverse effects on customers. However, it should be recognized that programming is an ever-changing field and therefore never free from errors. This should also lead the e-business to implement contingency plans for problems due to program malfunctions and have mechanisms in place to remedy such problems immediately. Part D, software licensing and work-for-hire contracts. Another aspect of programming that warrants brief mention for its legal implications is programmers' use of software and software licensing. For instance, a website may wish to use automated software for matching users up with products, but the contracted programmer is unable to develop a program due to budgetary or technological constraints. In such a case, the e-business or its programmer may look into commercial software available to meet this need. As most software requires a license for each distinct use, an e-business should make certain to pay for the license to use such software by its hired programmers. While this will increase the cost of programming services, it is important to ensure the software is being used legally so as to eliminate any possible cause of action by the software company. The cost of these licenses may be charged in the services agreement with the programmers, or the e-business can play it safe and arrange to pay the software licensing fees directly to the software developers. The latter option would prevent the e-business from assuming any liability in the case of an unscrupulous programmer who charged for software licensing fees but did not pay the software developers. Of course, this may not always be a concern, as many programmers use their own software and certain software is in the public domain. In drafting a programming arrangement, the diligent attorney should inquire into the software to be used and make sure any needed licenses are obtained. In addition to respecting others' rights in their software, it is important to take measures to protect the software and other materials, including the web page itself, databases, etc., developed for the e-business itself. All freelance and other contract work should be done on a work-for-hire basis, which, when specified in advance by the parties in their written agreement, allows for all copyrights in the contractor's work to vest automatically in the e-business. If such agreements are not executed in advance, then the material belongs to the contractor and the e-business must obtain a written license to use the work on the website, or preferably an outright assignment of all rights. The work-for-hire rights automatically accrue to employers when the creation of the website material is required as part of the employee's job duties.
Section 6, concerning security, has been removed from this audio version. Security issues include access attacks, information theft, and hardware and software damage. These issues have great implications for hosting and web development agreements. Please see the course website for the section on security.
Section 7, Marketing and Advertising. In order to be successful, an e-business must engage in advertising and marketing. These areas have more in common and substantial crossover with their counterparts in the traditional bricks-and-mortar business world than the more technology-specific concerns above. However, advertising and marketing in the online medium also raise considerable novel issues of which the e-commerce practitioner and e-business should be aware. This section will highlight some common modes of advertising and marketing online and examine some legal issues that may arise in those contexts. Part A, Advertising. Advertising one's website or e-business online usually takes one of two forms. One, the purchasing of an advertising space on another's website, or two, swapping advertising space with another business or participating in a general advertising exchange program. Purchasing advertising on another website requires determining an e-business's potential customers and finding an appropriate site through which to reach them. Advertising and marketing online offer e-businesses the advantage of reaching a well-defined target audience easily by buying space on websites whose visitors are in the same demographic as those sought as e-business customers. Websites are able to gather varying amounts of information about the types of visitors to their site, with sites requiring registration or subscription, particularly adept at gathering detailed information. This offers a distinct advantage over the types of data that can be gained from other media, such as television and radio. Instead of merely determining that a program is predominantly reaching the 18 to 25-year-old male demographic, a favorite group of television and movie executives, websites can give a more detailed breakdown of their audiences. This information can include sex, race, age, nationality, and other characteristics that make targeted advertising and marketing a reality, meaning less money is wasted going after groups to whom the e-business is not really catered. Websites can also give potential advisors information about the volume of traffic to their sites and therefore the size of the audience that will be reached by the advertisement. A preliminary step in finding advertising space is thus determining what types of websites attract users who would be potential customers of the e-business. In some cases, this may be easy. A golf news website would be a good fit for an online seller of golf equipment, while in other cases, more research will need to be done to determine a good fit between advertiser and host. Most large websites have links to general advertising information and contact information for their advertising sales departments. Prospective advertisers can then inquire into the audience they would reach by advertising on a particular website. One other option is to go through a large-scale advertising service such as DoubleClick that offers advertisers access to a network of partner websites in different categories. Such services act as middlemen, bringing together advertisers and those with advertising space in similar fields, eliminating many of the transaction costs associated with searching for individual advertising hosts. Utilizing such a service also will likely increase the audience the advertisement reaches by displaying a client's advertisement across a wider array of host sites, but this may come at the expense of reaching a more narrowly defined target audience. Legal issues in renting advertising space mainly involve the agreements between advertiser and host. An e-business may have different options in structuring these agreements, such as choosing to pay a fixed price for advertising for a particular period of time, paying the host on a sliding scale depending on the amount of traffic to the host site or actual clicks through to the targeted site, or paying the host a commission on sales made as a result of the ad. Issues concerning ad placement, number of views, viewership guarantees, ad tracking, and click-through fraud detection should all be spelled out in the advertising agreement. As an e-business's advertising needs are sure to change over time, an agreement should also contain provisions regarding changing specific advertisements during the course of the contract. Such a provision also allows changes to be made in response to consumer complaints or feedback. The advertising host likely will want to include in the agreement clauses indemnifying itself in certain situations. These situations, which should also be kept in mind if the e-business itself decides to sell advertising space, include copyright and trademark infringement, as well as cases involving fraud or misleading advertising. Copyright and trademark infringement issues may arise as a result of infringement directly in the displayed advertisement itself, or by linking through the advertisement to a site that contains infringing work. In the former case, the infringement itself is posted on the host site, and the host is therefore potentially liable for copyright infringement. To deal with these situations, the parties should agree upon which party is liable for such infringement, as well as create a plan of action in the case that a possible infringement is brought to the attention of the host or advertiser. The case of advertisements linking to a site that contains a copyright or trademark infringement may give rise to a claim of contributory or vicarious infringement against the linking party. Contributory copyright infringement results when one who, with the knowledge of the infringing activity, induces, causes, or materially contributes to the infringing conduct of another. Please see the course website for a case exploring contributory infringement in the advertising or linking context.
Part B, direct marketing. In addition to advertising, many e-businesses also reach potential customers through email. Contacting customers through email usually takes two forms, targeted emails directed at past customers or registered users of any business, or mass emails sent to a mailing list usually compiled by a third party. Many respected e-businesses use the first form of targeted emails to customers or registered users in order to keep these consumers apprised of new developments at the e-commerce site, such as new products, sales, or a new design of the website. When registering at a website, usually for the promise of greater access to information, products, etc., or when purchasing a product, most e-businesses usually ask for a customer's email address and other basic information. A common technique of many e-businesses is to have email offerings included in the options when a visitor signs up as a member of the website or purchases a product. Visitors are often given the option to receive regular newsletters from the e-business, emails regarding sales or promotions at the website, and a variety of other choices. These options are offered through a series of boxes that show a preference for the service offered when checked. A common ploy of websites to get visitors signed up for the services is to have all the boxes checked as the default, leaving the visitor to uncheck the boxes representing unwanted services. This is an example of an opt-out system. The consumer is required to take active steps to opt out of the plan of services. The passive consumer receives the emails as the default. The other option would be an opt-in plan, whereby the consumer who wished to receive emails would have to take active steps by checking the boxes to get on the mailing list. In such an opt-in scheme, the passive consumer receives nothing as the default. The question of whether to use an opt-in or opt-out scheme for targeted emails is a sensitive one that brings in questions of consumer expectations and privacy. An opt-out scheme may seem invasive to some consumers because they end up receiving emails for which they did not explicitly sign up. However, the user's feelings of inconvenience is probably less in this case than it is in the case where the user simply received unsolicited mail from a website or e-business with which he or she had no prior contact. This is largely because the consumer has already taken active steps to develop a relationship with the e-business, either by signing up as a registered member or by purchasing a product. Due to this relationship, the consumer has or should have more of an expectation that the e-business will contact him or her in the future and should not be put out by receiving emails from the e-business. Of course, the e-business should use discretion and good business judgment in sending emails. Consumers are a lot less likely to be bothered by a bi-weekly email than a daily newsletter or other persistent contact that may lead to annoyance. And an e-business should always make it clear in the email sent that the consumer has the option to opt out of the email service by sending a reply email to unsubscribe from the periodic mailings or by visiting the website to take the email address off the mailing list. Making it difficult to opt out of the mailings or not taking people off the list who wish to be removed may lead to people feeling harassed or invaded and may result in a complaint against the offending website. Some e-businesses may make the decision that they wish to play it safe and not offend anyone, and therefore use a strict opt-in sign-up system for marketing emails. Most, however, will find it is worth losing a small percentage of upset customers for the ability to reach more users than they would be able to with an opt-in scheme. Even if most who receive the marketing emails simply delete them, it may be worth it to send them to reach those who do read them and to take a chance that a catchy subject line can get the deleters to read the messages from time to time. In the end, an opt-out scheme probably will lead to a greater audience for these marketing emails and will typically not be considered unduly invasive due to the consumer's pre-existing relationship with the e-business. But the business should make certain that recipients who do not wish to receive emails have a quick and easy method of unsubscribing from a mailing list or otherwise opting out of the service. An e-business should not take lightly the potential for a strong negative reaction on the part of consumers due to the receipt of unwanted emails. The other major type of email marketing involves sending unsolicited emails to mailing lists compiled by an e-business itself or a third party. Unsolicited emails such as these raise significant concerns that do not arise where the parties have a prior connection. This type of system goes beyond a mere opt-out system in pushing emails upon potentially unwilling recipients because the recipients have no pre-existing relationship with the entity sending the emails. Due to this lack of a relationship, the emails are more likely to be viewed as an invasion of a consumer's privacy or as a form of harassment. Such unsolicited emails, also known as spam, are generally considered a form of junk mail and are typically utilized by and associated with pornography websites, get-rich-quick schemes, and generally solicitous and invasive businesses. The annoyance to and resulting outrage of recipients being associated with a certain type of business entity is enough to steer many e-businesses away from utilizing spam, but there are legal considerations that militate against such practices as well. In the case of Intel Corporation v. Hamidi, a California court used an injunction against a former employee of Intel who was sending unsolicited emails to Intel employees regarding the company's employment policies. The court based its ruling on a trespass theory, suggesting that such emails were tying up the computing resources and time of Intel employees and therefore causing material loss to the corporation. While this case involved a somewhat different factual situation than one where a wide range of potential customers is spammed by an e-business, it does show that certain forms of abuse will not be tolerated and that spamming can be illegal in certain circumstances. While courts have thus relied on existing legal doctrines to find some spammers guilty of unlawful conduct, recent proposed legislation in the states and in the U.S. Congress would make certain actions involved with spamming illegal. Because many ISPs have anti-spam measures and take steps to block spam coming from particular addresses or computers, many spammers jump from account to account to avoid detection and being shut down. The new proposed bill, the Anti-Spamming Act of 2001, provides for criminal penalties for Internet users who falsify their email addresses in this manner in order to send spam. The bill, whose sponsor views spam as a substantial burden on Internet users whose connections are adversely affected by the volume of commercial junk mail received, allows for monetary fines and damages awards against generators of spam. Several previous efforts to regulate spam by state lawmakers have been struck down on the theory that such measures, as state laws affecting interstate commerce, violate the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which gives Congress sole power to regulate interstate commerce. In addition to legal issues raised by reaching potential customers through unsolicited emails, there are other measures taken to prevent Internet users from receiving spam that may adversely affect an e-business attempting to utilize mass mailings. These include private, vigilante email blocking services, discussed in more detail on the court's website. In the end, the threat of an e-business's emails being blocked by a private service, triggering penalties under the proposed federal statute, or causing loss of business due to annoyance to potential customers led to the conclusion that mass unsolicited mailings are an unwise and potentially illegal marketing method to be employed by an enterprise. Furthermore, promoting an e-business via spam may also constitute a breach of the company's ISP host agreement and result in termination of service. The best way to reach customers, therefore, is through the aforementioned techniques of advertising or by using targeted email directed at past customers or registered users of a website.
Part C, search engines. Perhaps the most effective and cost-efficient means for an e-business to reach potential customers is through search engines, a method by which many consumers are matched up with businesses offering products or services they desire. There are two major types of search engines, web directories and engines utilizing spiders or web crawlers to catalog websites. Directories generally work by soliciting websites for inclusion in a web directory which has been searched by users. In this sense, it is an active process that requires affirmative action on the part of an e-business in order to get listed in the directory. The most well-known web directory is Yahoo, which accepts submissions from websites to be included in a particular category under the Yahoo organization scheme. Simply suggesting a site does not guarantee immediate inclusion into the Yahoo directory, however, as Yahoo must review the site prior to its inclusion to determine whether it is in the appropriate category and whether it is appropriate to include the website at all. Search engines that utilize spiders or web crawling technologies to catalog websites operate in a very different manner than web directories. These engines use technological means, often called robots or spiders, to scour the web and then catalog the websites and their search engines to be pulled up when matched with user search terms. An example of a popular search engine that utilizes such technology is Google, which uses its Googlebot web crawler to explore the vast offering of web pages available on the internet and index them for use in its search engine. This offers an advantage to e-commerce sites over directory services in the sense that no affirmative action is necessary to have one's website listed. The web crawler automatically adds all catalog sites to the search engine's index. In addition, Google offers submission of URLs to its index for faster addition. In contrast to the early days of search engines, the ability to purchase higher rankings on the top search engines no longer exists. Understanding the ranking systems of search engines, however, allows an e-business to take measures in several major areas to ensure higher placement. These areas include click popularity, stickiness, link popularity, and page-related factors such as tags and keywords. Click popularity is a measure of the number of times a search engine user clicks on a particular site when it is returned as the result of a search. The greater the number of users who choose a particular site, the higher ranking it will have. Stickiness is a measure of the length of time users spend at a site once they click through to it from a search engine. The greater the stickiness, measured by the length of time between clicks on different results of an original search, the higher the ranking the search engine gives the website. The greater the extent to which an e-business can further draw users into its website, the greater the stickiness will be and the higher the ranking. Link popularity is very important in certain search engines' ranking schemes. This metric basically measures the number of links to a website from other websites, giving higher rankings to sites with more links to them from other websites. In addition to measuring sure numbers, certain ranking schemes take into account the origin of the links, weighing links for more highly rated pages greater than those of lesser ranked pages. Thus, a link to one's website from CNN.com is given more weight than a link from Joe Smith's News of Wichita. The effect of link popularity on ranking schemes thus may influence marketing plans and determining affiliate and partnership agreements with other websites, as well as different advertising strategies. Page-related factors deal less with viewers' perceptions of a website and more with how a search engine reads the internal placement of keywords in the text of a website and use of meta tags in web programming. In this sense, while the above factors more heavily influence the ranking or placement of a site on a results page, the page-related factors are the gatekeepers for whether a site is returned as a result in a search at all. An e-business website thus must reverse engineer searches in a way, making a determination of how users will get to the site through a search engine or how it wishes these users to get to its site. The main way to ensure that users get to one site is to create a set of keywords that describe the content and product offerings of the website. keywords are incorporated into the meta tags of the source code. For more information on this process, please see the course website. Practitioners and e-businesses alike should be aware that a large number of cases have arisen involving meta tags and trademark disputes. Many of these cases have involved situations where, in an effort to drive traffic to their site and away from competitors, web developers have used the trademarks of competitors in their meta tags. One major case involving such a dispute was Playboy Enterprises Incorporated versus Wells. The defendant in that case, a former Playboy model, used the plaintiff's trademarks such as Playboy and Playmate of the Year as keywords in her website's meta tags. Playboy claimed that the use of these trademarks by her site, which was a competitor to Playboy's own website due to the adult content, constituted trademark infringement. The court, however, granted summary judgment for the defendant, ruling that, as a former Playboy model and Playmate of the Year, the defendant was entitled to use the trademarks to identify herself as such under the fair use exception of the trademark doctrine, 15 U.S.C. sections 1115(b)(4) and 1125(c)(4). In other cases where a fair use defense has not been available, however, the competitor's use has been found to constitute an infringement. In Brookfield Communications versus West Coast Entertainment Corporation, the defendant used the plaintiff's trademark, MovieBus, in both its domain names and meta tags. The appellate court reversed the district court's denial of preliminary injunction for the plaintiff, ruling that irreparable injury would likely result from the defendant's continued use of the trademark in the domain name and meta tags. On the meta tag issue, the court stated that, while West Coast can legitimately use an appropriate descriptive term in its meta tags, plaintiff's trademark MovieBuff was, quote, not such a descriptive term, end quote. Plaintiffs have prevailed on motions for preliminary injunctions in similar cases involving the use of plaintiff's trademarks in defendant competitors' meta tags. These cases sound a stern warning to e-businesses thinking about using competitors' trademarks in meta tags. However, they should not prevent an e-business from using as its website text terms that may be trademarked but are used for descriptive purposes in accordance with trademark's fair use doctrine. To this end, an e-commerce practitioner should be familiar with the relevant sections of the trademark code dealing with fair use and run a trademark search on any potential keywords that may be trademarked by a competitor. And to the extent that these issues will be encountered in website development, a web development agreement should incorporate an e-business's policies regarding tagging for search engine placement.
Section 8, Conclusion. Like any business venture, developing an e-commerce website involves contributions by a wide variety of parties and engenders important legal considerations that have the potential to derail even the most well-intentioned entrepreneur. The previous discussion is meant to highlight some of the major issues e-businesses will face in getting up and running. The list is by no means exhaustive, and every e-business will encounter a different set of circumstances that may require additional issues to be addressed, or the same issues to be addressed in different ways. The remainder of the course will take a more in-depth look at particular legal issues in the e-commerce context, including transactions, consumer privacy, and disputes.